I'm going to tell you some, tell you some ideas, toward a generalization of statistical mechanics for general covariance systems. And in particular, I'm going to tell you about this auto-coupled general covariance system as a first step toward this direction. The work is done in collaboration with Hal Haggard and Carlo Rovelli, and it's still in progress. So yeah, really some ideas. The point is to get some reaction from you. So this is the outline of my talk, motivation, brief introduction of some concepts, how to couple general covariance system, and then some conclusion very quickly. So what is the goal, the main goal, the ultimate goal of this line of research? The goal is to define, to find a thermodynamical or statistical mechanical consistent description fluctuation of gravitational fields. And why this is interesting, because this can have a lot of a big importance in situation where we have for example in cosmology and black hole physics, so where energies are so high that not only matter fluctuates but also gravity could fluctuate, and this could play a big role in our physical description. This can be interesting also from the perspective of the people doing actual discrete approaches in quantum gravity. So in the characterization of the continuum limit, the thermodynamic limit of these proposals. And also, this should give some insight, should shed some light on this interplay between gravity, thermodynamics, and quantum field theory on a general level. And it can be also, an interesting guiding, can provide some interesting guiding lines in the study of quantum gravity again, because in a statistical description of gravitational field, we want to define distributions over geometries. Somehow in quantum gravity, what we do is defining wavelengths over geometries. So it's a very nice, a priori, in principle, it's a very nice subject to be studied. You said, but is it a reasonable something? Subject to be to study. It's very controversial, because basically all we know about statistical mechanics is related to Hamiltonian dynamics. Basically, the theorem of Boltzmann in the 1860s relying on two hypotheses. One was the atomic hypothesis, and the other was the ergodic hypothesis. The atomic hypothesis is telling us that basically the microscopic dynamics is a Hamiltonian. So when we have a general covariance system, we are missing all this information, because a general covariance system, is described by some Lagrangian, which gives us a vanishing Hamiltonian. So we have no notion of energy, so we don't know a priori how to define canonical, microcanonical ensemble. We lose the notion of a preferring flow of time, so we don't know how to object would thermalize in time, basically. And this, make the notion of equilibrium, which is the fundamental one, very subtle in this sense. So how do we attack this problem, if we really want to attack this problem? By starting from very simple steps. So take this line. We want to describe an equilibrium. So equilibrium is assuming some thermalizing interaction between systems. Thermalizing interaction means dynamical coupling at some level. So the first step to do is study how to general covariance system, the simplest we can think, like harmonic oscillators, couple in a consistent pressing plectic description. So what is dynamics typically? When we study the dynamics of a system, we typically define the partial observables of this system, its configurational space. So and in doing that, typically, for example, consider a pendulum. We have we take elongation and a clock, and define the dynamics of this object with respect to a particular reference observable, which is time. So time plays a fundamental role in the conventional description of dynamics. Another way to tell this is that dynamics is all the information in conventional system dynamics is expressed in terms of Hamiltonian. So in the phase space, the flow of time is associated to the vector Hamiltonian vector flow. So what happened when we go to general covariance systems? When we go to general covariance system, as I was saying before, we have a vanishing Hamiltonian, and basically the dynamics is coded into constraints. So here, I'm introducing this because we are going to use this cartoon a lot, because this is our phase, extended phase space. The extended phase space contains the partial observables and their conjugate, so dynamics is gauged. So where is the physical information about dynamics here? It's not anymore in the phase space by itself. In statistical mechanics, we always work in the phase space, so we have to find out in which part of the phase space now we want to work. But it's in the physical phase space. That is the phase space associated to the solution, to the gauge solution of this system. So dynamics is gauge, but I mean the gauge orbits are characterized by new observables, which are gauge invariant observables. These gauge invariant observables that when we quantize become the operators of our theory are the physical quantities we want to use. So in particular in this let me go home. Okay, so starting from this picture, so imagine we have, now we want to couple two general covariance systems. So we want to merge this presymplectic description in terms of extended phase spaces, constrained surface, and physical phase space of the two. What we do classically is trivial. We take two systems, we take their two phase space. We product the two phase space, so we take the Cartesian product of the two phase space. So kinematically, we build the larger phase space. Then we have the Hamiltonian as a sum of the two Hamiltonian, which set the dynamics for the two, and then we can couple them by introducing some interaction, which means adding a term to the Hamiltonian. So we take the recipe, and we want to see if it works for general covariance system basically. And the answer is yes, it works, as we could expect. It's just subtle, but it's simple by somehow. It works, and it's in the sense that we have our two systems with their own standard phase space and their own constraints. What we do is kinematically we put them together by considering the Cartesian product of the two phase space, so we get a symplectic form, which is the sum of the two symplectic forms. And we have a dynamics which is still defined in terms of two constraints. So we coordinatize this extended common phase space in terms of the partial observables of the two systems together. And the dynamics here is in the constraint surface associated to each one of the two extended phase space. That again we can consider as a Cartesian product, and naturally we get a presymplectic form which is a sum of the two. And in the case where we don't consider any interaction, you are just providing a unified description for the two systems together, so they are not effectively interacting at this level, at this mechanical level. Then we have that also the physical phase space is a Cartesian product of the two. So basically no problem in this sense. The problem starts when you conceptually want to understand what does it mean to have a unified description? Because this system is basically described by two times, since you have two constraints. And there is no, I mean, natural way to choose one time with respect to the other. I mean, in terms of a relational approach, you can always pick one observables and describe all the others with respect to this one. So how do you make this choice? This can be said like.
But the time for one particle is not going to be a time for the other one.
Yeah, exactly. Why? Because you have two constraints. So you have two different dynamics encoded in two constraints. So this is the point, exactly. So basically, it seems that to get an effective unified description, you have to make a choice. That is, you want to define a single time for the two particles. The single times implies some coordinate transformation, canonical coordinate transformation in this Cartesian product phase space. And this coordinate transformation implies a redefinition of the constraint, which is just algebraic, basically, but has a very heavy physical meaning, because you're basically saying that one constraint, the one that you associate to the new time, which is a combination of the two time, for example, is a Hamiltonian constraint. Therefore, the other constraint that you have by consistency, and you need by consistency, would be some gauge constraint. This gauge constraint will basically tell you that one of the partial observables you have, the common observables you have for the system, is not playing any role in the dynamics. It's associated to a quantity which is gauge. So basically, you're kind of reducing your system in this way. You're saying, OK, time flows in one direction. I lose track of the other one. Then, I mean, this is what we were looking for. I mean, this is consistent with our expectation. But I mean, is there any way we can single out the time for this system in a more physical, reasonable way? Yes, this way is using the so-called thermal time approach. So we want to link the notion of time for this coupled system to a concept of equilibrium. So we define. And we know how to do it in terms of the thermal time. So we define a statistical state in the physical phase space of our system. We say that this statistical state define a vector, an Hamiltonian vector field in our physical phase space. And this Hamiltonian vector field define a flow, which is a thermal flow. Now, this flow is associated to a so-called thermal Hamiltonian here, that in the particular case where, and so this is a general, this is a statistical state, is a function on the physical phase space of the system, and the thermal Hamiltonian here is not characterized. But in the case where we want to pick up a particular state, an equilibrium state, then this thermal Hamiltonian becomes effectively thermal, in the sense that you have, it's like having a deparametrization of the theory. This thermal Hamiltonian becomes a Gibbs state, so it's like beta H. So using this approach, what we are able to introduce, and using the fact that once we have a time defined on the physical phase space, we can reconstruct time on the extended phase space of the system, of the coupled system, we find a way to introduce a time for this coupled system. Now, this time is associated to an equilibrium state, as we were saying. This equilibrium state, basically, if we consider that you are just taking a minimal interaction between the two systems in order to have equilibrium, but this interaction is not skewing the information about the two subsystems you have, can be expressed in terms of factorization of this thermal statistical state into substates which are defined on the single, on the individual sub-physical space of the system. So basically, what you have is that you can recover the time. I mean, you can see this common time in terms of two components living on the single subspace. And once you have this common time and you know how this is related to the two, you can go back. Okay, 2 minutes. Yeah, you can go back and define and reproduce the canonical coordinate transformation you had before. So you get this key, the one that before was related to the difference of the time, and ask, okay, what is in this case what was the meaning of the gauge fixing in that case? Something that which looked arbitrary at that point. Well, this is very interesting because if you reinterpret the gauge fixing condition in this statistical approach, what you get is that fixing this gauge gives you a condition on the thermal time of the two systems. Now, this condition on the thermal time of the two systems, so this equivalence of the two interval of thermal times, has a very, very interesting explanation, which was given by Haggard and Rovelli last year, which is expressed in terms of information, and this is basically a condition of equilibrium. So what happens in your physical space? The thermality, I mean, fix the cell, the dimension of the cell on your physical space, if you want. When you move along an history, so for a process which brings you from a solution to another in your physical space, you're basically covering a number of cells. This number of cells can be related to some information from the point of view of the other system which is in contact with you. So basically at equilibrium, since every flux through the two systems should be zero, you can state that also the informational flux should be zero. And it tells you that basically even if the dynamics on the single subspace is independent on the other, somehow, you are spanning the same number of cells, which have different size. Now this is can be recasted in exactly in this form. So what are you seeing is that basically the gauge fixing at the mechanical level, so without any information about the equilibrium, was related to a condition of equilibrium. Somehow is consistent with a condition of equilibrium. And so this is a 1 minute, 2 minutes, zero. Okay. So this is so. Let's see. Okay. Conclusion. We learn how to couple general. We learn that we can couple general covariant systems in a consistent presymplectic way. This is a nice example of gauge and equilibrium for me. And we know that we learn what are the subtleties in doing that. The subtleties are related to the relational approach we use. So the fact that we really consider partial observables, and we see that we somehow to get a common description, we have to get rid of some of these observables. This is very interesting in the sense that basically this hidden relation between equilibrium and gauge fixing is somehow reminding us something like a coarse graining process. So if the common time is related to an equilibrium condition, so there is some thermalization interaction between these two subsystems, then some degrees of freedom is lost. And the number of effective observables with this kind of system are reduced. And then there is a comment, which is that fact that all these information is encoded in observables which are not gauge invariant, so are not the one that we typically use to describe our theory. And this is something which works for in many many cases. The fact that we don't pay attention to the non gauge invariant observables, but they seem to be fundamental in order to represent, in order to describe interaction between system and in order to describe the way these two systems couple together. And that's it, very close.
Any questions?
There was this question of choosing the state, your equilibrium state.
Yeah.
Is there some restriction for that? That's the one, if I understand correctly, that determines your client.
Yeah, basically,
state.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want, you have an arbitrary choice at the mechanical level, in the sense that you choose which combination of time gives you the single time, and therefore which combinational constraint gives you the Hamiltonian constraint. This arbitrariety is somehow you find it also in the way you choose the thermal state, because this is, all the description which follows then depends on the state you picked. So the only information you need is that is a thermal equilibrium state. So you can actually deparametrize the theory and write this Hamiltonian, this thermal Hamiltonian, not just as an H where all the information is entangled, but really as an Hamiltonian times some beta. So basically this beta is a rescaling factor that you will ever have in your description and you cannot fix. Yeah, what you have is that, if you think of your single state is an equilibrium, the nice thing of general covariant system that you see also in gravity with the Tolman-Ehrenfest effect is that you can still split, factorize as a property of equilibrium state the state in substates, but each of these substates has not the same temperature, so has not the same beta. It will be like a product of e to the beta 1 h1 times e to the beta 2 h2, so each one keeps his own beta. And then there is an extra, if you want, global beta, which is a basically you can interpret as a reservoir temperature that is something you cannot fix. But it's the ratio between beta 1 and beta 2 that tells you the real information between how fast you move in your phase space, your physical phase space. So you don't really need beta, the overall beta, to understand the physics of equilibrium.
Quick.
Yeah, sure. This beta, couldn't you fix it using the minimization of the entropy?
The beta.
You were doing this with Carlo in the first paper on.
Sure. I mean, once you define a state, basically the point is that your state is the minimization of entropy, which gives you an equilibrium state, is fixing the single beta for each subsystem, right? And this
each
is
subsystem, you can minimize the entropy of the subsystem.
Yeah. Okay. And then this is what you get. Like the Gibbs state is the byproduct of this minimization. Right, is an equilibrium state is exactly what you get after you do this process of minimizing. But then, basically, this is enough to gives you a thermal time for the, what we get is a common thermal time for the system. You never get an effective internal time for the system. And sorry, it's here maybe. Fortunately, I didn't have the time to put all the formulas. But so, this is the point. This is what the statistical state, common statistical equilibrium state gives you. Then you want this time, but there will be always this beta rescaling, if you want. And the only thing you really know, because you define it when you, I don't know if I put it, no, when you define these objects which are known, the only thing that you know, in fact, is beta 1 and beta 2. So I don't know if I answered the question.
So my question is exactly on this slide. So you say this defines the particular combination of C1 and C2.
Yeah.
Is this just the sum of the two or something?
In this case, yes, because it has to be consistent. I mean, you have a set of Poisson brackets in your symplectic manifold. So you use once you have T expressed in this way, like T proportional to beta, the sum of these, basically you have the same situation you had before. No, what is it? Well, T1 plus T2, but with some coefficient. It's like having T equal alpha T1 plus beta T2. So the conjugate of this T will be a sum with the same coefficient of the conjugate variable, which is the conjugate of T, and then the constraint, which is here, will follow. So it's every time is always linear in this sense.
But
this linearity.
Non-linear function of these two constraints, right? Like C1 times C2.
Yeah, I mean, when you start from the, mechanically, yes, you can in principle build whatever combination of these constraints. Then the linearity is the simplest thing you can start with, but then at the equilibrium level, the linearity is the only thing you are left with because it comes from the factorization. So these are. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, next speakers. Talk about discrete gravity. You have to take the microphone.
I'll be talking about discrete differential forms and their applications to gravity. This is part of ongoing research at the UC Berkeley group. Why do we need to study discrete differential forms in gravity? There are two main reasons. The first is that numerical integration of the Einstein equations requires discretization. experience with integrating ordinary differential equations has shown that symplectic integrators have significant advantages, such as improved numerical stability, greater long-time accuracy, and exact conservation laws even under discrete time stepping. Discrete differential forms offers an avenue for implementing symplectic integration in field theories, in particular in gravity. The second reason is that discrete gravity is the classical limit of certain quantum gravity theories. For example, the action of Regi calculus plays a central role in the semi-classics of loop quantum gravity. Discrete forms provide us with a discrete theory of gravity, which is more flexible than Regi calculus and has a simpler transition to both loop quantum gravity and continuum GR. Now, I'll tell you about discrete differential forms, which are the main theme of this talk. All actions can naturally be written in the language of differential forms. Discrete forms provide a concrete, natural algorithm for discretizing such actions and obtaining discrete equations of motion. These, in turn, have many desirable features, such as preservation of the multisymplectic structure, exact conservation laws, and exact preservation of constraints. For example, the Gauss constraint of E&M has been shown to be preserved under symplectic integration. All of these facts lead to greater numerical stability. The use of discrete forms in gravity is fairly recent, although discretization of the action dates back to Regi calculus, first developed in 1960. It'll be interesting to compare and contrast the two approaches. I will now tell you about how to implement discrete differential forms. We begin with the triangulation of a smooth manifold, which allows us to replace the continuous data of a smooth differential form on that manifold with a discrete set, which are the integrals of that form over simplices of the appropriate dimension. For example, a differential K form will be integrated over the K-dimensional simplices of the triangulation. These integrals encode all of the information of the discrete form and ultimately become variational parameters in a discrete variational principle. We can build a discrete exterior calculus by defining discrete analogs of such continuum operations as the wedge product and the exterior derivative. For example, given a discrete k-form alpha, we can define its discrete exterior derivative d alpha, which is a k plus 1 form, whose integrals over the k plus 1 simplices are given by taking the wedge products of alpha and beta, whose integral over the k plus 1 simplices are given using Stokes' theorem in terms of the integrals of alpha over the boundary k simplices. This natural definition for the discrete derivative has the advantage that Stokes' theorem is an exact property of the discrete theory, and this is critical for conserving currents in discrete field theories. Knowledge of a discrete R-form alpha and a discrete S-form beta allows us to construct their discrete wedge product, which is an R plus S form. In this example, I will take the wedge product of a 2-form alpha and a 1-form beta. The integral of the resulting 3-form over a 3-simplex is obtained by taking the wedge product of alpha and beta at each of the vertices of the 3-simplex, and then averaging over all of the vertices of the 3-simplex. While this discrete wedge product has the graded commutativity of its continuum of its smooth counterpart, it lacks associativity, which is, however, recovered in the limit of finer and finer triangulations. There are many equivalent ways to write this wedge product formula. The simplest for interpretation is obtained by using a sum over the R faces, seen here. This complicated linear combination of simplices over which beta is integrated can be simplified by defining a dual cell. The dual cell to a k-dimensional simplex is an n minus k-dimensional surface, where n is the dimension of the manifold. It is obtained by extending lines out from the center of the k-simplex to the centers of the k plus 1 simplices containing it, then onto the centers of k plus 2 simplices containing it. Let me show you, So the wedge product formula simplifies as such under the definition of the dual. Let me show you an example of how to construct a dual cell. In four dimensions, to construct the dual to this 2-simplex, we extend lines out from its center to the centers of 3 simplices containing it, then onto the centers of 4 simplices containing it. And the result is the dual cell shown here. With the use of this dual cell, the integral of beta can be reduced to an equivalent integral over the dual cell, greatly simplifying the wedge product formula. With these exterior calculus operations in mind, we can discretize the gravitational action. We begin with the form version of the gravitational action obtained by using Cartan's tetrad approach. We discretize it and then apply the discrete wedge product to factor the action into 2 terms. The first of these can be shown to be the area of a triangular face times a projection operator onto the plane orthogonal to that face. We can visualize this discretized action as follows. Each 2-simplex in the triangulation contributes its area along with the projection operator onto the plane orthogonal to it. Each dual cell contributes an integrated curvature, and the projection operator multiplies this integrated curvature, projecting it onto the plane orthogonal to the simplex. We can understand this projected curvature more naturally in the course of parallel transport. The integrated curvature to leading order generates the parallel transport transformation, while the projected curvature generates the projected part of this parallel transport transformation, which is really just an angle of rotation in the plane orthogonal to the triangular face. I must stress that although the action uses only the projected curvature, the theory does retain all of the components of the integrated curvature. This projected curvature is seen most famously in Regi calculus, where to discretize the gravitational action, Regi triangulated a smooth manifold and then considered a piecewise flat metric, flat on the 4 and 3 simplices of the triangulation. The resulting curvature of such a metric generates rotations in the planes orthogonal to all of the 2 simplices, or bones as he called them. The angle of rotation is exactly the projected curvature derived with discrete differential forms. However, whereas in Regi calculus this is the only component of the curvature, discrete differential forms allows us to retain all of the components of the integrated curvature. We can now return to the discretized action and perform a variational principle to obtain the discrete equations of motion. In doing this, we have 2 options. We can take a first order or second order formalism. In the second order formalism, we require torsion vanish, which will set the second term to 0. In Regi calculus, this is accomplished by the use of the Schlafly identity, and indeed the 2 computations are very similar. In the first order formalism, we set both terms independently to 0 and extract the vanishing of torsion from the equations of motion. These discrete equations of motion are just the discretized continuum equations of motion, which was to be expected. The discretization prescription is not obvious here due to my use of the dual cell. However, the actual prescription can be recovered by returning to the original action and expressing it purely in terms of the fundamental discrete variables, which are the discrete tetrad and connection 1 forms. We are now in a position to characterize the connection between discrete differential forms in Regi calculus more completely. On the one hand, we can begin with the discretized form action and use the projection operator to obtain the Regi action. We can then use Regi's discrete parameters to vary this and obtain the Regi equations of motion. On the other hand, we can perform a variational principle directly from the discrete form action to obtain the discrete equations of motion. However, we notice that the projection operator does not survive the variational principle. And thus, we really are using all of the components of the integrated curvature in our theory. In this sense, the discrete differential forms provide a generalization of Regi calculus. In practice, solving the discrete equations of motion is made very, very difficult by the combination of gauge degrees of freedom and constraints. So instead, we turn to the ADM formulation. We write the ADM action as an integral over time of the ADM Lagrangian. The ADM Lagrangian is an integral of a 3-form over the 3-dimensional hypersurfaces of the ADM foliation. We can discretize this integral using the technique of discrete differential forms. And then the action becomes an integral over time of a discrete system and can be discretized using any of the standard approaches of particle mechanics. Obtaining a symplectic integrator with the use of, for example, the leapfrog technique. Now, there are many interesting future directions that discrete differential forms allows us to take gravity, discrete gravity. For example, we can consider doing numerical simulations with our discrete equations of motion. I think it would be interesting to understand the discrete symmetries which underlie the conservation laws and constraint preservation of the discrete theory. We can study the multisymplectic structure of the theory, which should be interesting in its own right and can also connect with the two previous points here. We can try using approaches which are closer to loop quantum gravity, such as the Ashtekar connection or the Plobansky area forms, and discretize from those actions. We can even consider quantum aspects of this theory, such as a path integral or the study of semiclassics. In any way you look at it, I think discrete differential forms offers a fresh take on discrete gravity and will be very useful for the future of discrete gravity. Thank you.
As you said, that the batch product is not associative?
Yeah.
Have you checked, the action you present is typically E batch, the curvature. So have you checked if it makes a difference?
There's lots of choices you can make for the wedge product. We're making a particular choice. All of the choices agree to leading order. And since that's all we really are interested in, I mean, it's an approximation. So it'll be good to some order of accuracy.
So and leading order in the spacing or something?
Yeah, in the lattice spacing. So actually, there is some debate. I believe we've chosen the one that if you construct a cubic lattice, it'll actually give second order error, which is the best you can do. Other approaches will produce first order error, regardless of what lattice you choose. There's a disadvantage. If you choose any other lattice, you get first order error even with ours, although it captures some of the first order corrections.
In the equations of motion that you get from both sets are equivalent, how many more how much more information is in the discrete forms version?
Yeah, this is a slightly complicated question. In the beginning, we allow all six of the components of the integrated curvature. It's a Lie algebra valued element, whereas Reggie only allows one. However, those will be constrained by the vanishing of torsion, and also there's gauge symmetry here. However, there's no reason that there'll be a few more degrees of freedom per simplex that our theory allows. Reggie calculus only allows rotations in planes orthogonal to the simplices. We, in general, allow arbitrary rotations. These will be reduced, of course, by gauge freedom and the vanishing of torsion, but not enough. Standard Riemann curvature tensor has 20 components. Reggie keeps one. We try to keep more. So I think that we'll have enough so that over a simplex we at least capture the full Riemann curvature tensor. Whereas in Reggie calculus you'd need on the order of 20, 40 simplices or so to capture that. Yeah.
So you said that you don't keep associativity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an estimate of? Do you have something that's similar to a commutator, but an associator, I guess, that captures how much you lose?
Yeah, and that one is, so I haven't computed it myself, but other people who have done this approach have. And it has been shown to be first order in the lattice spacing for a general lattice. And then, as far as we can tell, it would be second order for a cubic lattice.
But
The reason it would be second order for cubic lattice is that this type of approach is you can use it in one dimensions, and we sort of know what the best approach in one dimensions is, and it's second order in error.
I mean, I was just wondering if you had a specific numerical application in mind, like somewhere where you could do better than.
The reason I suspect we can do better is because this is going to be a symplectic integrator, rather than the standard approach to numerical relativity, which uses a 3 plus 1 split on the equations of motion. That one is not symplectic. We expect some of the constraints to be preserved. I'm not sure which ones. It's a little bit tricky. The idea would be to continue along with sort of the second to last slide and sort of express the ADM equations of motion, express them in the fundamental variables, and then try to, you know, see where we can go from there. Any of the simulation. I mean, that's my hope. I don't know if we can. You know, we can also put matter on the lattice. It's actually not that hard. My hope is that we can do it. People have expressed skepticism due to someone's tried to do this before and they ran into problems with gauge symmetries, but they also had errors in some of their formulas. So I don't know if that was the cause.
Could you maybe comment on the fate of diffeomorphism symmetry in the discretization? Or let's say you have like a discretization of a flat solution. Do you have some remnant of the diffeomorphism symmetry there too?
So I have been thinking about that a little bit. As far as I can tell, the discrete theory has a diffeomorphism symmetry in the sense that it's integrals over surfaces, and integrals are diffeomorphism invariant. We have a different sort of point of the discrete differential forms has a different point of view than Regi calculus. We stick to a triangulation of the coordinate manifold, of the coordinate grid, if you will, whereas Regi's trying to imagine an actual space-time that's decomposed into simplices. Where our simplices live on the coordinate grid. And so if you shift our simplices around, you'd imagine that in the real space-time, you're tracking different parts of your curvature. But the integrals are diffeomorphism invariant. So I suspect that, yeah, as far as I can tell, if you shift the lattice and you change the value of the differential form, I'm actually not sure. But diffeomorphism symmetry is certainly broken in Regi calculus. It may or may not be broken.
For non-flat solutions.
I mean,
if you have a flat solution, then you can move around vertices and the action is actually varying under that.
I'd have to check that, but I mean, if the curvature vanishes, I'm not really sure if there's anything left over. Could make the connection vanish, and we have the tetrad. You would have to. I don't know. I suspect it does have the symmetry, but yeah, I haven't checked.
All right, let's thank the speaker again.
Not Ed, no.
Your first name was Ed.
Nope. I don't know an Ed.
I called you Ed during the Super Game.
I know. That's okay. Ed was on our team.
Huh?
There was an Ed on our team.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so Christopher is going to talk about top spin networks.
Okay, so thank you guys for hanging around for this talk. Topology change with top spin networks. This is a continuing project which I've been working on with my advisor, who's a mathematician. So I'll talk about topology in loop quantum gravity, why we should care, what's its role in loop quantum gravity, and then these things called top spin networks, and the short answer for what they are, they give you a representation of the spatial section as a branch covering space. And so I'll hope to explain to you what that is. And then basically the calculation, I just wanted to give some very concrete examples of these top spin networks and what topologies they actually represent. And then briefly, I'll discuss some model building, which will sort of be the next thing that we're going to try to do with this. So first, what is topology? So when I say topology, what I mean are things that you can measure by topological invariance, fundamental group, homology groups, those, any kind of information you can measure that way. If you don't know what any of those things are, I'm talking about the difference between a sphere and a torus. One has a hole, one doesn't. This is the advanced way of saying that. So unlike geometry, topology is not part of the background independence of GR. You have to put it in by hand. And this was actually discussed in the panel discussion. A similar thing is true of the dimension and differential structure. These things you have to put in by hand. And this, there's a very nice paper by Lee Smolin talking about GR not being a purely relational theory. And so the idea here would be, if you wanted to make it more relational, here is one way to do it. Because you want to say, well, where does this topology come from? And if we could say a quantum theory of gravity, that would be a nice answer. May not be the only answer, but it certainly would be nice. So at first glance, it appears that canonical loop quantum gravity completely destroys the topological information. It's very easy to see this. So you start with a three-sphere with a spin network embedded in it. You're basically restricting all the continuous information on the three-sphere to discrete information on the graphs. So then if you want to reconstruct the three-sphere, you don't know what to do. So here's a very simple picture to show that. Two perfectly fine spin networks. There's an isotropy between these two edges, so these two should describe the same spin network. You can embed them in a three-sphere. You got no problems there. But if you embed them in something that was topologically inequivalent to a three-sphere, like a torus, these two are now inequivalent. The spin networks have no idea that they're inequivalent, but they are. They cannot be isotroped into each other. Okay. So the idea is to try to modify loop quantum gravity in such a way so that their spin networks can actually see this difference. So you can't take this spin network and deform it into this spin network if you're embedded things in a torus.
If you turn the torus, that's going to be the same,
no? Okay. in the Toriolda case, you could flip the torus in some way to see it. But imagine if you had more holes, right? It may not always be that way in general. Yeah. No, that's definitely true. For my example, that's true. So the idea is that you want to include the topological information, but mostly preserve all the loop quantum gravity structure. You don't want to destroy the nice structure, which exists. So the two definitions I have to give you are pretty intuitive. They have a mathematical, technical background, but they're fairly intuitive. First thing is a covering space. Covering space, just you can look at my picture. I have a circle, S1. This is called the base space. This is a covering space. It's multiple copies of the base, which just map down to the base. Okay, so this is a covering space. It's a disjoint product of three copies of the base. That's a covering space. The branch covering space is the same thing, but with singularities. Okay, so in this case, I've given the same exact thing, except the two branches are crossing at some place. This is called the branch locus. In one dimension, I have a point here, and the two lower branch sheets are crossing each other. This gives you a topologically different thing than this. So it should be fairly obvious. These things are topologically very trivial. These things can have some topological information encoded within them. Okay, branch covering space. So the basic tool here is a very classic theorem from mathematics. Any compact-oriented three-manifold can be described as a branch covering of S3 branched along a graph. So the picture, like the previous two pictures, is something like this. Three-sphere on the bottom, some number of copies of the three-sphere in the cover. I've just picked three. I have a graph here and an intersection along the graph up there. Okay, so this is generically a branch covering space over a graph. What's really nice about these things, not only can you describe any compact-oriented three-manifold in this manner, there's a very nice way of labeling it. So what I have is that here I'm identifying the top two covers. If I just stick a permutation label on the symmetry group right there, on the symmetry group with three elements, onto that graph, that encodes all the information of the cover. So I can get rid of all of this junk and just say, I have a base space, which is S3, I have a graph, and I have some labels. And that will allow you to reconstruct any topologically inequivalent compact-oriented three-manifold you like in this manner. So hopefully it should be fairly obvious what the goal is. These are graphs. Spin networks are graphs. Let's add these labels to spin networks and hope to come up with some kind of way of measuring the topology of a spatial section. These things are called top spin networks. They're first discussed in this paper from a couple years ago. So the point is that you take this thing to be your spatial section, this arbitrary topological three-manifold. I should say it's a smooth three-manifold. The topology is arbitrary now. And the top spin networks will track both the topology and the geometry. Here's an example of a top spin network. It's a spin network with additional labels. Here, I've again just chosen a three-fold cover to represent these kind of things. You can think of this as just modifying the usual approach to loop quantum gravity. It's completely compatible with the usual spin networks, except that it allows for arbitrary spatial sections. The Hilbert space and operator structure are completely compatible with loop quantum gravity. This is the paper that came out last year. This was a big deal, obviously, because we don't want to destroy any of that nice loop quantum gravity stuff that exists already. And as a slight aside slash advertisement, this Alexander's theorem is actually very powerful, more powerful than how I'm using it here. It applies in dimension 4 as well. So in dimension 4, you can have any smooth 4 manifold described by covers of the 4 sphere branched over surfaces. Okay? And so the advantage of this is this covering representation provides both the topological structure and the smooth structure of the 4 manifold. This is a very unique feature in mathematics. The classification of manifolds, of smooth 4 manifolds, is solved for n less than 4 and n greater than 4. It's unsolved for dimension 4. This is called the exotic smoothness problem. In dimension 4, if you have a smooth 4 manifold, there could be infinitely many smooth manifolds which are not diffeomorphic, meaning gauge invariant. Gauge different up to the gauge, but topologically the same. You can have an infinite number of spheres in 4 dimensions. So normally, we have no idea how to deal with that. If you have a partition function which includes a sum over all 4 manifolds, that's an uncountable set. You have no idea what's in there. This actually allows you to completely specify what is contained in that thing, in that, for instance, a partition function. So this is actually where I came from studying this problem, is from the exotic smoothness problem. But in fact, in 4 dimensions, it also provides a representation of the gravitational field in a new set of data, in terms of surfaces and in terms of topological labels. So that it allows you to reparameterize a 4 manifold, which therefore reparameterizes gravitational field. So just an advertisement for how powerful this basic representation technique can be. So I want to show you what kind of topologies these things can actually get you. So this is an algorithm which allows you to calculate the fundamental group of the spatial section from a topspin network. It's adapted from knot theory in this really nice paper by Ralph Fox. So we're going to restrict to the connected case. Disconnected topological manifolds is something which would be very interesting for cosmology, because this would be two merging 3 spheres, for instance. This is something you would definitely want to study. It should be generalized from this at the moment. I'm just going to stick to the connected case. I have G-fold cover, so I've been specifying to 3. In this case, G is 3. So you can construct the fundamental group in the following algorithm. So you start with what's called the graph group. So the graph group is just the sphere minus the graph fundamental group of that thing. And that's generated just by a label for each edge, A, B, and C, and some relations on the vertices. So this is a group, given a graph, I can write down this group with no issues. Now there's a homeomorphism which maps all of this group, which lives on the base, into the cover. And what I get is I get, you know, a bunch of generators which are now mapped into that many generators times G living in the cover, and that many relations times G here. So you get this group, which is the fundamental group of this thing, and it's just huge. It could be a large number of generators. But what you end up doing when you do this homeomorphism is you actually end up adding in a bunch of stuff that's trivial loops in the fundamental group. And so it's very easy to figure out how to remove those. It's basically just taking out trivial frames like this. And you actually also have to remove the branch locus. But these issues are things that you can do. The algorithm is well defined. I'm not giving it to you, but you can do these things. I mean, I can answer questions about it if you want, but it's not so important. So, examples. Simplest possible spin network you can have. 2 vertices, 3 edges. This would be something like the tetrahedron models. I've also chosen the number of covers to be 3. I like 3 covers because it's the first non-trivial case, but this 3, in general, could be anything. I can talk more about that if you want, but it's not so important. So the complement group here is generated by A, B, and C, 3 edges. There's an additional relation, C equals AB. I have 3 covers, and so I now have 9 generators and 3 relations, 3 times 3, 3 times 1. And so then after you have this giant group, which represents the fundamental group of the cover with some additional relations, you can just go through this process and figure out exactly where all these trivial relations are, which come from attaching a trivial frame here and these branch loci and stuff like that. You can go through and figure it out, and what you find is that this thing is topologically trivial. So this topspin network represents a zero fundamental group in the spatial section.
So here you made a choice, a specific choice in the second line. You said
this?
No, second. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here you have a relation C0 is equal to A0 B1. You made an arbitrary.
So what happened getting from here to here is given by the topological labels, by the permutation elements. So I didn't exactly, I mean, I made the choice when I put these labels here, and that's what gave you this. But my next box will show that that doesn't matter, which is that regardless of how many edges there are, and in fact, regardless of what labels I put here, as long as it's self-consistent, this thing is a sphere. So this thing is always has always a topologically zero fundamental group. And in fact, because we're in three dimensions, you can do better. You can get the homology groups from looking at the fundamental group. By Poincaré duality, this is the same as this. And so actually, this thing represents a real sphere. This is not a homology sphere of some kind. This is zero fundamental group and then trivial homology groups. This is really a sphere. And so this is exactly what you expect, right? I mean, people are doing cosmology with these things in the spin network case, and they get trivial topologies, and they should be getting trivial topologies. So this, in principle, you could map this right into loop quantum gravity and say, we are really studying a trivial topology when we do loop quantum cosmology, for instance. So that's a very nice result. You'd like to say, OK, can we get non-trivial things? Well, it's pretty easy to get non-trivial things. So this is a spin network, which is basically coming from the action of the Hamiltonian, adding an extraordinary edge. In this case, you know, you get all these relations. You get now six relations, which you then have to map to the cover. And you get all this big, ugly mess. But if you work through the algorithm, then you'll get that the fundamental group is just the free product on two elements. So this thing it has a non-trivial fundamental group. It also has z plus z for the homology groups. So this thing has a different topology than the first case. Now, I don't know exactly what to call this thing. It's something like a torus, but it's in three dimensions, so it's not exactly like a torus. But it has different topology than the spatial, than this case, which is really what we wanted. So OK, fine. So we have two topologically inequivalent spatial sections. Well, you can do this with topspin foams, too. So you don't know what the dynamics of loop quantum gravity are, but you can do topspin stuff in a topspin foam case as well, just by making sure that all the labels coincide, just like you do with a normal spin foam. So this is, looks like this. Up here, this is topologically a sphere. This is topologically whatever that last thing was. So it has boundaries, which are inequivalent three manifolds. And this is really an honest, smooth four manifold, not something that every spin network can say about itself. Not every spin network can say that it is definitely given by some smooth four manifold. If it's a triangulation, this case it is, because we can check with all of these various labels. So this represents a transition between the trivial spatial topology and this new topology. And the claim is that, of course, this is the next thing you want to study, because you want to actually calculate the transition amplitude in a real case for some topological change. So this would be the next thing we want to study. So I'd like to just summarize what I've talked about. We want to look for topology change using this structure, these topspin networks, which includes the topological data. I presented this modified Fox algorithm, which can be used to identify the topological class of the spatial section. This is still only in the connected case, but you know, the disconnected case should be fairly trivial to work out. Just wanted to get some reasonable results before we started trying to do it. Any two-vertex topspin network is a sphere, completely in line with what the loop quantum gravity community would consider to be a simple spin network. And I have a topspin foam which represents the changing of a change in the topological amplitude, change in the topological character. Sorry. So the next thing to do is to continue with the topspin foam. Of course, you know topspin foam models, at least in the spin foam case, the models are proliferating. Right? There's lots of different possibilities. So picking one to use that might be kind of complicated, but it certainly would be a nice approach. As of yesterday, I know that there exists a group field model which has Sn as a symmetry group. So essentially, that is literally calculating the partition function of this thing, which is now possible as of yesterday. I didn't know about this. So this is definitely something that we're going to look into, is trying to do a group field theory approach using these models, which will just give you our partition function almost, you know, descended from heaven. And then, of course, you'd like to do some model building to study topology change with these new swinger representations and twister formulations. It's very nice to you can formulate, you can give some initial states in the Hilbert space, and then you can basically just sort of play around with some Hamiltonians, which should give some topology change. Which is, you know, this is unique because for classical gravity has no topology change built in. You have to, if you're going to get to some topology change, you have to do something special to the quantum theory. One way of approaching this is to try to play around with some Hamiltonians which give you topology change and basically see what they look like to see if they make any sense. So doing this with the Schwinger representation, you'll be able to do this. You'll be able to play around to sort of model what topology change might look like in quantum gravity. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Classical general relativity doesn't have topology changes built in. What is the physical reason for wanting to include them in the quantum theory?
I agree that it's somewhat philosophical, right? I mean, maybe it just is that when we have a triangulation or a spin network, we need to specify that the topology never changes. But it's a little suspicious, right? I mean, you have a spin network, which is just a bunch of edges connected, and then somehow the spin network, you know, proliferates more edges, and we take some semi-classical limit, and somehow we restrict the number of topologies that the thing is embedded in. So you really need, if you have spin networks, to go to the classical limit, you need another step, which is, oh yeah, by the way, you have to stay in this topology and not change. So if you want to get rid of that restriction, this would be one possibility. Not the only option. You could put in a forcing of the embedding of the spin networks into trivial topologies, you know.
Well, so as you mentioned, the spin network doesn't know about the topology,
yeah.
So it looks like it wouldn't be able to change it unless you start including these and then include a dynamic.
But if you start with a spin network and then work only on the spin network and don't refer to the topology, then how do you, I mean, you're either forcing it to stay in S3 or you don't know anything about the topology. Those are the two options.
Right.
Yeah.
And also from the path integral ID, usually it's custom to think that we should add also other topologies. Like if you do the GFT program, they're going to generate many topologies. They're going to sum over topologies. So you're kind of adding in the game the topology. And that's kind
of, I guess, yeah. I'm not sure why. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, the standard path integral usually says, oh, yeah, we also sum over topologies here. Yeah.
So you said it includes topological data. How much? Like your theorem only works for manifolds. So what happens if you lose the manifold structure somehow?
Well, then you're not doing. Then I think you're not.
Can happen.
Yeah, but then you're not doing physics, which should be able to be taken to classical limits. I mean, it's true that.
That's not true. You can get structures that are non-manifolds in the quantum limit. Are manifolds in the classical limit.
So the case. So essentially, what you're saying, there are some restrictions on what these labels can be, which happen at the vertex, which are the same as similar to the intertwining restrictions. So if you wanted to include things that were not smooth manifolds but topological manifolds, you could get rid of the restriction here and I could have 0, 1, 0, 2, and 1. And that would allow you to produce any given set of manifolds. And then if you wanted to restrict to smooth manifolds later, you certainly could. But you could get all topological manifolds doing that way, if you so desired.
So this SN GFT, actually, this was another colored GFT? Because I have a principal question about this program. I mean, if you go, for example, to colored GFTs, they already correspond to full triangulations, decomplexes, and there the topology is fixed by this combinatorial structure, basically. So from this perspective, if I had this, I wouldn't need the old data, right?
Right, so I don't understand enough about group field theories to answer that. I don't know that the topology that they're referring to is exactly what we mean by topology.
This is somehow related to the first question, because either you go to a really simple setting where you already have a topology, or I mean, if you go to the older LKG picture, there you actually, I mean, you fix your topology in the beginning, and your spin networks are just embedded graphs. So in this case also, it's already fixed. I mean,
There's no like theoretical issue with restricting your topology to be trivial all the time, you know. But I think that if we think of spin networks as discretations of space-time, also if you're thinking of triangulations as wanting, you know, some kind of dynamical triangulation system, I mean, you want to be able to specify what topology you get out of that thing. So yeah, I mean.
So the basic point is that I mean, if you have a bit more structure than graphs, then you already fixed your topology.
Yeah, and the
data, right?
Right, and the advertisement is that this is easy to do in loop quantum gravity, so we should be doing anyway.
This is the approach, for example, which is in GFT quad manifest, in college GFTs, which already exists, so their topology, I mean, is on a and definitions under control. And this kind of your approach is complementary to this, does that?
I think so. I tried to ask about this yesterday, and I didn't really get a satisfactory answer to my liking. I mean, they seem to say they have spheres, but don't end up with much else than spheres, if I understand things correctly.
I think they have a different recipe to construct the manifold.
Yeah.
So they have a graphic structure, which is decorated by stuff, and they have a different recipe to reconstruct the manifold or the space, all of it. You have a recipe, they have another one.
Yeah, I mean, it may be complementary. That's definitely possible, yeah. It might be, actually, that might be why this thing is showing up here, is maybe I'm doing something very similar.
Do you remember if this was colored? It's not a colored GFT.
It looks just like this. I mean, it's colored by labels in the symmetry group, in S3. Yeah, colored in that manner.
What about dimension here? It seems to me that you're making some choices of dimension somehow.
You fix the dimension. You fix the dimension to be 3. And then you have to have graphs as the branch locus. If you fix the dimension to be 4, you have to have surfaces of the branch locus. It's part of the structure. So the dimension is fixed in the construction, yeah.
And so if you were doing 3D gravity, so 3D gravity usually can be also described in terms of spin networks and stuff like that. So could you rewrite 3D gravity just in terms of your top spin?
Yeah, should be very easy to do.
Because now gravity is only about topology, right? So
right, yes.
You should encode,
I mean, in fact, in that case, you might not need the spin part of the spin networks. It would be completely given by these labels, by the permutation labels. Because then essentially what it's saying is that you have a bunch of simplices, which are all spheres connected in some way to give you an arbitrary 3 manifold. I mean, that's exactly what they say in 3D gravity, right? So, yeah. You know, you don't get a handle construction, but you know, you could pass between the triangulation and the handle construction if you wanted to. Yeah.
I think it would be useful. I mean, it would be interesting.
Yeah, actually, we haven't thought too much about that, but that's certainly might be worth looking into. Yeah.
One question?
From the point of view of quantum gravity in modifying our understanding of classical differential geometry, We expect that stuff like this will have a natural, will arise naturally from representations of a group. Is that the case in this case?
From the representations of the group?
Yes.
Of like SU2? No. So I think it's fair to say the representation of the group gives you the curvature.
So for instance, spin networks, there's this scan relations which allows you to see that it arises naturally from group representations.
But I think that gives you the geometry. I'm a little unfamiliar with what you're talking about, but I think if you do the scan relations, I think that provides the geometry of gravity, but not the topology, not the topological structure. Is that wrong?
So I just wanted to know if you can get this naturally from just representations, abstract representation theory.
No, I would say not. I mean, you really need embedded graphs. You need to represent the spin networks as embedded graphs in some topological 3 manifold. So just representation theory would not get you this.
It doesn't come from groups. I think he's got labels for SU2, and the other labels are not labels of our
I mean, I would argue that spin networks from loop quantum gravity also require information about an embedding. And so you can't get representation, you can't get it only from representation theory, but that might be an argument for a different section. Yeah.
And do you have any suggestion for the dynamics for the topology? Now you can play with topology, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, I can set up an interacting Hamiltonian. But the question is, what are the initial and final states? And how do you do interacting mechanics in this picture? I really don't have any idea. You know, I've been thinking about it. I don't have a good solution, so.
Because in 3D gravity, that would be...
In 3D gravity, it would be a much better idea, yeah.
It would be exactly all of them.
Yes, it would be very easy, in fact.
All right. Let's thank Christopher again. And that's the feature of the session.
There's the clicker.
UNS. And so UNS is going to tell us about spec contribution.
All right. Yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak here, and thanks for staying. I will tell you about some work on the spectral dimension in and Laplacian definitions of Laplacian in loop quantum gravity, which is work in collaboration with Gianluca Calcagni and Daniel Auriti. So the general motivation is to characterize the geometric meaning of quantum gravity states or quantum histories in loop quantum gravity in a broad sense, that is with the spin foam dynamics and GFT dynamics picture in the background. And in particular, to look at the spectral dimension, because the spectral dimension is a special observable, special number, which is much discussed in various approaches to quantum gravity. And there are not too many results on this in loop quantum gravity, and would be good to know more about this. Steve Kalb already in the morning talked about the spectral dimension quite in detail. So let me just quickly remind you that the spectral dimension is this number, the scaling of the heat kernel trace, which is the solution of the heat equation, which describes the diffusion of a scalar field on some space or space-time structure. And in a quantum gravity context, you want to take some expectation value of it. You can have a more explicit definition in just taking logarithmic derivatives. And then, while in the first place, you would have to go to some regime of this diffusion parameter tau, you also can consider the spectral dimension actually as a function of tau with this explicit definition. So what can it be good for? It's an indicator of topology and of geometry. And why so much interest went into it is, besides other reasons, that that's a good tool to compare various approaches to quantum gravity, because you can have definitions of this object in conceptually very different settings. And the findings of dimensional reduction also triggered the interest into it. And if this turns out to be something about nature, then it might be interesting to look into fractional quantum field theories as effective theories in intermediate regimes where you have non-integer dimensions. So before you start, you have to, in loop quantum gravity, to look into the spectral dimension, you actually face a problem that so far the Laplacian entering the definition has been which was used as has been either just combinatorial in CDT or just in a smooth setting with the typical continuous dispersion relation. But in loop quantum gravity, also in regular calculus, we actually have discrete geometries. That is, we have geometrical data on some kind of lattice. So we actually found out that an extension of discrete exterior calculus, which you by now are already quite familiar with, is appropriate to have a definition of this of the heat trace. So we can have a definition as the usual Hodge and Laplacian is defined in terms of exterior derivative and the co-differential on any p forms, on abstract simplicial, so purely combinatorial decomplexes, when we attach to the simplicity some geometric data, basically some volumes. So what we are interested in is a scalar field diffusing. So we look at the field phi, which lives at the dual points. So on whole, you can dually think of them of it as living on the whole d simplices or on points. And it turns out that the Laplacian then is just a sum over nearest neighbors. So if you, for example, take the Laplacian at this point, I think it's dying. So if you take the Laplacian, for example, at this point of the scalar field, then it's a sum just over the neighboring dual vertices, and is equipped with some geometric data. So some simplex volumes and volumes or areas of the boundary face between the neighbors, and of some dual geometric data, namely the dual length. And yeah, we have developed somehow this formalism a bit further, also with a bracket formulation, to because in this formalism, you basically have to have various dualities between the primal and dual complexes, and also between chains and cochains. And we have a formalism which quite nicely deals with these calculus. So we can then provide geometric data in terms of degrees of freedom we need for Lucrenian gravity, similar theories, either in terms of edge length or in terms of d minus one phase normals, or in 4D really of phase, that is d minus two phase bivectors, which are fluxes, or equivalently area angle variables. There's only one issue geometric data on the dual complex. There is some ambiguity. You can either have barycentric or circumcentric duals. So you can either take the dual lattice built of barycenters of the simplices or of circumcenters, which gives you different dual geometric data, and therefore also slightly different properties of Laplacian. And we tend to fix this ambiguity by demanding that our Laplacian is positive, which is for physical reasons interesting, which prefers the barycentric dual. So before we now we have the definition, we could start calculating spectral dimension in loop quantum gravity. But before, it's helpful to remind some classical features of the actual discrete structures, the purely combinatorial discrete structures underlying. In particular, typically we have only finite graphs or complexes, which when they are closed correspond to some compact topology. Some very easy example in the smooth case would be the circle. And when you look there on the spectral dimension, which is under good control analytically, you see that only for small diffusion parameter, it's actually a constant dimension. But then at the order of the curvature of the circle, there's a fall off to zero, which you can think of when you think of the heat trace as a return probability, which is another way of thinking of it. It's easily to be understood because on a scale of diffusion time of the curvature, the particle can go around your circle, and the return probability becomes basically constant, so the scaling is zero. You can you have it under control also for tori, where you have a bit more geometric data, some more radii, so you can have different slopes, but the same basic features. For spheres, you have used spheres, and the slope is also slightly different. And in particular, it's this actual plateau is not as stable as in the circle or tori cases. So this is the topology effects and geometry effects in the smooth classical setting. On the other hand, if you now still in the classical setting look at discreteness effect, for example, in the easiest case of a hypercubic lattice, an infinite one, you see that at the scale of your lattice spacing, the diffusion time goes for small values to zero. So there's another effect. And typically has some small peak above the topological dimension. And if you now look at at finite lattices, toroidal, you see that you have both effects. You have this discreteness effect, and you have again the topology effect. But you can have larger and larger triangulations, so they are in the limit approximating the infinite case. And what we're interested in is to do it for actually for triangulations, not for cubic lattices. which basically only differs here in this discreteness artifact. So it's not very important, but you can have the same convergence. But you see that to recover a concept of dimension, you really have to go to this regime between the discreteness effect and the topology effect. Only there you actually see dimension and also geometry. So you can think of it dually also if you take the triangulations as refinements, so of a given size, but you refine the triangulation, it's equally approximating the actual smooth case as it should. So there's classically some continuum limit, so that's under control. If you try the same for triangulations of the sphere, it's a bit difficult because equilateral triangulations, you only have the boundaries of platonic solids. So you only have the three cases of tetrahedron, octahedron, and icosahedron. And they are much too small, actually, to even for this discreteness peak get to the topology dimension. So these are apparently discrete structures, which are too small to say anything about dimension. And even worse, if you look at the dipole, which is often used in various contexts, you see that independent of the dimension of the sphere, this dipole is a degenerate triangulation of. You have only a peak at the same height. So also this doesn't help much. So the lesson from these preliminary considerations is that for a proper analysis of spectral dimension, you should have large enough complexes underlying your states. So we choose the toroidal complexes shown before as the graph structures underlying our states we're looking into now. So 2+1 dimensions are not only easier, but also helpful if you want to see quantum effects of the geometry, as in 4 dimensions you also have the problem of geometricity. So 2-dimensional spin network states are geometric from the start, so you can directly go and look into quantum effects. And the expectation value of the heat trace basically goes through to an expectation value of the Laplacian on spin network states. And these you can basically have the action of Laplacian as in, you can take the edge Laplacian and you get a Laplacian as a function of the J spin labels then. So we first looked at coherent states, which are peaked on, again, the classical equilateral geometries. And in the semi-classical approximation, the C-trace expectation value basically is a Gaussian sum, which is a huge sum. So for calculating it, we take randoms, we sum over some random samples with this Gaussian measure and get something like this. So we're now already focused into the actual interesting regime where there was a plateau. And we have here states peaked on JS10 with some various spreads. And it's more interesting to actually look at the difference of these plots to the classical case it's peaking on. And what one basically sees is that the deviations are really quite small, of the order of 10⁻². So indeed, these coherent states seem to approximate the classical geometry peaked on quite well. But then you want to extend already, for example, here with the spread, to some more quantum states and look for quantum effects. And one idea is to look at states which are peaked only on the extrinsic geometry, such that in the internal 2D geometry they're totally spread, which is technically hard to implement. So we have some approximation to this by just looking at totally spread states on some intervals. And we see here again that the deviations are still quite small, which opens the question if the spectral dimension in this context is sensitive to quantum effects at all. So we haven't seen larger quantum effects so far. So let me conclude on this so far. For discrete geometries, we need a new definition of Laplacian to analyze the spectral dimension. So we have an extension of discrete exterior calculus appropriate for the quantum gravity contexts to do so. We have figured out that we need large complexes to actually have a concept of dimension. We have seen that semi-classical states provide a good approximation to the classical case. And stronger quantum effects we actually haven't seen so far, not to speak of dimensional reduction at all. But dimensional reduction is actually a dynamical dimensional reduction in the cases where it occurs. So we have started also to look into superpositions of states over this, the scales peaked on, and also over complexes of different size, somehow to mimic the essential feature of CDTs, where you sum over complexes. But also in CDT, it's not well understood where the dimensional reduction actually comes from. And also, so far, we haven't seen any more interesting effects there. As it's dynamical, you actually, as an outlook, you should go to spin foams for sure. But there are bigger challenges. In the first place, in spin foams, you want to look at this at the heat trace expectation value in the spin foam. So in the Plebansky integral, in the discretized Plebansky integral, basically. And would this heat trace be a polynomial that is factorized into so-called ultra-local terms? You could actually use earlier results on such expectation values, and use the simple expressions of the Laplacian and heat trace we had before. But as the heat trace is not that simple, you basically would have to solve this integral at once. You cannot solve it step by step. So we're not really sure how to do this. So there we are kind of stuck in the ultra local approximation, which is not very well controlled. If we do so in the simple setting, there are degenerate configurations which lead to imaginary contributions of the heat trace, which can be interesting as well, but need further interpretation. In spin foams, you have the issue of divergences and the regularization. It's actually so far good understood. So you can choose maximal trees to fix the gauge thereon. But in choosing maximal trees, you basically reduce your combinatorial structures such that this definition of heat trace kind of trivializes. So they are not really applicable in this context. And in principle, there's a technical challenge of doing the sum for large complexes, which we need, apparently, to have any interpretation. So that's it. Thank you.
Any questions? So in the 3D case, you were not yet able to calculate. Or you got three, or you didn't get it. Did you get three or not? Because you were mentioning the 3D case, right? 2 plus 1.
So the two plus 2 plus 1 LQG we calculated on kinematical two-dimensional kinematical states, where we got the two.
Oh, you got two anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, but two from two.
Two from two. Yeah.
So could you try Fontana Reggio model just as a toy example?
Yeah, so basically the last slide was,
okay.
I was still in the 2 plus 1 case when referring here to these results. So this is Ponzano-Reggi. And so you have this problem that if you want to do it properly, you would have to do this integral. So because to go in the actual spin representation of the integral, you would have to do this integral. But As the structure of P is not factorizing that nicely, it's actually not clear. So you don't get just an easy expression in terms of the spin labels. So taking the naive form inferred from the edge length spectra is not clear if it really approximates the full integral, which that we've done. And there, so far, the problem is rather in the size of the complexes. So we've done it for very small complexes, where we know that there's not much to be expected to be seen, as you've seen from the classical cases.
In 3D, you kind of know how a particle is defined. So I guess you could implement that in the game. But in 4D, it's harder, I guess, to define a particle.
So we're actually not taking this 3D particle concept of conical singularities or anything. But we're really just dealing with test fields. So we take the Laplacian, we take a definition of Laplacian acting on test fields, but then don't consider the actual field anymore. So we just take this form of the Laplacian, because it's just what appears a trace of Laplacian. So we're not dealing with any physical fields here. And in so far, there's no problem to go to four dimensions. So this expression is